This is the new TC Pride Podcast, episode 55, part two of the 2016 Voices of Health Survey with Rainbow Health Initiative.
So Dylan, I wanted to mention, Joanne mentioned the value of data, of gathering data from maybe other organizations that aren't LGBTQ focused. But I was looking through the snapshot here and I wanted to talk to you about that as well. But even, you know, as an LGBTQ focused organization, there are some challenges in gathering data to use for these purposes.
Yeah. So when you think about how you're going to gather information from any group of people, and you think about what are your resources, you know, we can't do like a population level survey, which is sort of like what the census is. It's what the American Community Survey is. It's usually governments are able to do population level samples because they are larger and have more resources. We don't have the capacity to like take a sample of all of the population of Minnesota and then identify the LGBT people within it. So we end up using a convenience sample, which is actually quite common across the country in LGBTQ research, because it's what folks are able to do. So it's basically going out to Pride events, posting things online, word of mouth, sharing it with different LGBTQ organizations, and then, you know, telling people, hey, will you please take this survey? Here's the work that we can do with the survey. One of the things that RHI does with our data and with our research is we are intentional about making sure that other LGBTQ people and organizations are able to use our data for their purposes. So when we're looking at our surveys, you know, we every year we sort of consider what questions worked well, what questions didn't work out so well, what new information do we want to know. We sit down and look across and see where were there not many changes. You know, if we didn't see a change in a rate, we can probably not ask that question for a year and then come back to it, which gives us space for more questions. So one example would be in 2015, we added a question about experiencing homelessness. So whether you had ever experienced homelessness, how many times you'd experienced it, and if you were currently homeless at the time that you took the survey, which we had never been able to ask that question before 2015. And very important then to sort of get it's not a super deep level question. It's not how old were you when you experienced homelessness? How long of a duration was it? It doesn't, you know, describe whether it was someone couch hopping or, you know, staying in shelters, or it doesn't really describe fully the experience, which would be sort of the next step, but it does get that initial, like, let's see, that 32 respondents had been homeless at least once in their lifetime. And then when we look further into that data, we can see that, you know, bisexual people are more likely to have experienced homelessness more frequently. So they were more likely to say that they'd been homeless three or more times compared to lesbian, gay, queer, transgender respondents. So as a very specific example of what we can kind of go in and ask, I often work with John when I'm looking at, and the other RHI staff, but, you know, talking with John about what's going on with the education program, what sort of information would be useful for the program. A lot of the education program has been built on what we have found in the survey over the years, starting, you know, with the questions like, are you out to your doctor? And looking at the percentage of people in different identities that are out. You know, bisexual people are less likely to be out to their doctor in our survey, which is consistent with national information. And I think a lot of that is, you know, it might be partially that maybe people don't feel like it's any of their doctor's business. But also, I think that doctors aren't really prepared to ask appropriate questions to make bisexual identified people feel comfortable coming out to the doctor. Maybe they don't even know the questions to make a lesbian or a gay patient feel comfortable discussing their sexual orientation with them. So a lot of that is figuring out how can we ask questions that allow people to, you know, best describe their own experience in a way that feels meaningful. I think that we also look at other surveys to sort of compare rates. So we'll look at what are some of the like state conducted surveys. Well, what are the questions that they ask about alcohol use or tobacco use? What are the questions that they ask about experiencing depression? And try to ask a question that's constructed similarly so that then we could compare the rates from our convenience sample to that broader general community sample to sort of get a benchmark of how are LGBTQ people doing compared to the general population. When we think about, you know, going out into the field and actually conducting the survey, it's a lot of volunteer hours. So we recruit volunteers. If you are looking for something to do at Pride and you'd like to get a gift card and a free t-shirt, you can volunteer with RHI to help collect surveys at Twin Cities Pride. I would love to have you. We have volunteer survey collectors who, you know, learn a little bit about, you know, here's a little script that you can use to approach someone to take the survey. Give them a pen and, you know, walk through, here's what the survey's about. And then, so we have lots of people that are, you know, milling around the park and are at our table trying to get as many LGBT people to take the survey as possible. And then we also, as I mentioned before, we go out to all the prides around the state trying to recruit surveys as well. We have our SurveyMonkey online. And just the idea being to, if we can get as many people as possible to take the survey, we can get a broader snapshot of what's going on across LGBTQ communities. We are really intentional about trying to partner with other organizations, so wanting to send it out so that we can make sure that we are really getting a good snapshot across age, across race, across LGBTQ identity. When we look at what are the questions, we just sort of assess, you know, is this a useful question? What more do we need to know? This year, 2017, we're adding questions around substance use and abuse, some different sort of questions. We've asked questions about alcohol use, but we're starting to dig into other like prescription drug use, whether if it's not a drug that was prescribed to you, if you're using it not as was prescribed, looking at opioids and other sorts of drug use as well, since we've never asked that before and have been getting a lot of questions from people, actually. So that's another thing that guides if something gets into the survey, is if lots of people ask, what do you know about whatever topic in LGBTQ communities? If we don't know anything, it's a sign that we need to add it. So
okay, and Joanne, you talked about how valuable just this data collection can be and the actual data can be to the organization. How important would you say just having this data is to getting those resources that you said are so crucial to being able to do your work?
Without the data, we can't build a case for support with any organization, because if we don't have the data, they don't have the data. So many times you will see an RFP for a grant, and they will talk about structural racism, and they'll talk a lot about institutional, systemic disparities, but they frequently focus only on communities of color and don't always understand the intersections between communities of color and the LGBTQ communities. And then they don't include the LGBTQ community at all. So if they don't, again, if you don't have the data to support it, it's really hard to convince organizations, funders, sometimes even the state of Minnesota, that there are disparities that can be and need to be addressed, and that there are people who have the capacity and the ability to impact that change if they were willing to provide the resources. One of the things that Dylan mentioned that we've added to the survey this year is information about questions about the substance use. And in part, we're doing that because we know that the Department of Human Services has received a significant federal grant to address opioid use. And we know from our work with them that they actually understand that there are health disparities in the LGBTQ community. And so they will entertain a request from us. No guarantees that we'll get the money, but at least they will entertain a request for support from us to do something about that, collect more data, develop some policies, develop some best practices for therapists and providers around substance use issues within our communities. So it's really the foundation of everything that we do. And as I said, it just builds the case that stories are great, but having the data to back them up is critical.
Yeah, and John, so, you know, Dylan mentioned that you two work together. You take the data and that helps influence your educational materials, and then the other way around. How critical is this data to you when you're educating providers on issues that relate to the LGBTQ community?
It's critical. As I said earlier, a lot of care providers will go through their entire medical training and never be exposed to this at all. And we have a medical system that historically has not valued queer and trans bodies the way that it has valued straight and cis bodies. I mean, even the terms homosexual and heterosexual, these were terms created by the medical field to stigmatize people who are engaging in sex. So for homosexual, it was created by the medical field to denigrate and to stigmatize people who are engaging in sexual relations with people of the same gender. And for heterosexual, this was a term that was created to stigmatize folks who are engaging in sex with persons of opposite gender for pleasure, for not for the purpose of procreation, right? So we have a medical field that ignored major crises, HIV, AIDS, you know, basically did nothing around that. The mental health field spent a better part of the 20th century pathologizing queer and trans bodies, stigmatizing them, making them less than. So we need the data to demonstrate that there are health disparities, but also to get around, to stop them just pathologizing us, and also to stop the erasure of queer and trans communities. The medical system is really, and our cultural system is really set up to erase queer and trans narratives. So the data is really important to stand up and say, look, this is happening in the community. And then also to note that these health disparities are not intrinsic to queer and trans bodies. That one of the main models that is trying to explain why we have LGBTQ health disparities is minority stress theory. And minority stress theory says that it's the stress of a queer or trans person navigating these hostile environments that is causing these health disparities. And one of the subpoints of that is this expectation of rejection. And so that's where we ask this question of, are you out to your doctor? And then this year we're trying to add an additional question of, if you're not out to your doctor, why aren't you out to your doctor? Because this is really kind of an eye opener for care providers. They think, I'm here to provide medical care to help out this patient. How could they be sitting there and thinking, I'm gonna reject them? And yet we see that as a reality. Not for all, you know, LGBTQ folks. You know, some folks go in there and they have an expectation that their doctor is going to provide them the care they need. But some are sitting there and going, I don't know what's going to happen, because they've had this lived experience of either a parent or a sibling or a teacher or a principal or a boss out of nowhere rejecting them, pushing them away, sexually assaulting them, physically assaulting them, right? So we get these care providers that suddenly go, oh, goodness, wow, there's the, you know, they may have this expectation of rejection. And that completely changes how they approach that initial clinical encounter. So how they're going to set up, not even before they even ask the questions, right, of taking a social history or a sexual history, just how they're going to set up asking those questions of a queer or trans client. How do they build that trust with that client so that it doesn't just become a meaningless encounter, right, where the client is half answering questions because they're afraid that the doctor is going to reject them. And we do see this, unfortunately. It's a small percentage, but it's still, you know, a 2% in the most recent survey of respondents to the Voices of Health survey said that they were outright denied service because of their LGBTQ identity in the past year.
Yeah, that was something we were also talking about, Dylan, before we started recording here, is there is that sort of open question right now about how much responsibility should lie on the provider to ask the right questions to make sure that they're caring for their patient in the right way, and how much responsibility should lie with the patient to make sure that providers are addressing things correctly. And you mentioned that there are privacy issues involved with that. There's a whole range of issues that are involved around that question. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit more.
I would say that when I think about it, structurally, and I think about you know, individuals moving through a medical system. And so individuals can certainly at any point kind of choose, like, I don't need to tell the doctor about my sexual orientation or my gender identity. It's my business. The doctor doesn't need to know that. And, you know, that's a choice an individual can make and is should be able to make to kind of say what is, you know, part of their life that they don't want to share. I mean, also, I will say that I think the onus then is on the provider to set up a practice, a clinic, where LGBTQ people feel like they are able to share the whole aspects of their life, and that they're able to feel that any of the behaviors they're engaging in or any of their experiences are fully welcomed there. And I think this is also one of the places where the standards of inclusion and our survey research that supports the standards are important, is that it's looking at, it really impacts people beyond just sexual orientation and gender identity, because it's really at the core making people feel like they can bring their full self to the doctor, and they can bring their full lived experience and share that and not fear that they're going to be rejected because of any piece of it. So, you know, whether that's someone who's a sexual assault survivor and doesn't feel like their doctor is trauma-informed, they're probably going to keep things from their doctor, or they're not going to go because they don't feel like it's going to be a safe experience, and that it feels better to just not go then, which is, you know, that's where some people are. So I think it's really the provider's responsibility to make as welcoming of an environment, and an environment where people can share share their full lived experience, and then if an individual chooses not to disclose something, that's their personal choice to not disclose then, which is a fine wonderful choice to make.
So we have we see a phenomenon, particularly with guys who will self-identify as straight. They'll on their intake forms, they'll talk about having a girlfriend or a wife, but yet they will still be engaging in sex with other guys. But it never comes out, right, in the clinical experience, because the care provider hears on the form, this is a guy, he's identifying as straight, he's talking about his girlfriend or his wife, so I'm just going to presume heterosexuality there. Now, when you look at care providers or, you know, public health policies designed to address, you know, STIs prevention, how to address, you know, better, safer sex practices, if they're not designing a clinical environment that takes into and allows an individual to fully express with their provider their full sexual and social histories, then we're never ever going to get to the point where we're addressing reducing rates of sexually transmitted infections in the state of Minnesota. We're never going to get to a point where HIV cases are zero if care providers are not creating an inclusive and welcoming environment for all types of identities inside their clinic.
The TC Pride Podcast is a production of Podlitter Media and Twin Cities Pride. Subscribe now on iTunes, on Android, or on YouTube at tcpridepodcast.org.